Last year at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, three researchers looked closely at the sexual attitudes, knowledge, and practices of University of Alaska Fairbanks students. They wanted to know what they could do to help students keep from getting HIV and AIDS. What they found was a student population at risk. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Today, we'll talk about that survey and more. My guest is Dr. Donald Novak with the Communications Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Donald, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
When I say let's talk about the survey, let's look at generally what it says about students. And then I want to move on to what you think that means. When you think about the survey, what are the most important things it tells you?
Well, it tells me, first of all, that the students here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks are, in fact, practicing and involved in sexual behaviors that can put them at risk. We know that 85% of our students have or are currently engaged in sexual practices with other students or with other significant others on campus. What that means is ultimately that those students have a chance of contracting a sexually transmitted disease. We know that there is no such thing as safe sex. There's only safer sex practices. And because of that, we know that everybody who engages in sexual behavior is potentially at risk.
Do you think everybody knows the difference between safe sex, that phrase, and safer sex? Can you give me a...
Probably not.
Give me a notion. What's the difference?
Well, most people, when they hear the term safe sex, assumes that if you're involved in a monogamous relationship, that is a one-on-one relationship with only one other person in which you both were virgins or didn't have any sexual behavior prior to that relationship, and you maintain that is relatively safe sex. The difficulty with that is that it's hard to know whether or not our partners are in fact being safe as we are. And the other thing is that early on in sexual transmitted disease research, people thought that there were safer practices, and so they began to talk about safe sex, that if you engage in these kind of behaviors, it's safe. If you engage in other kinds of behaviors, it's not as safe. We realized very quickly that that's not true, that in fact all sexual behavior puts a person at risk simply because you're involved in very intimate bodily contact, and that's just the kind of contact that diseases need in order to spread from one individual to another. So now we talk in terms of safer sex, that it's important to reduce your risk of contracting or acquiring a sexually transmitted disease simply by making sure you reduce the transmission vectors. And that includes, obviously, any kind of moist area, any kind of contact that would increase the likelihood of transmission.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are students at the University of Alaska Fairbanks looking after themselves? Engaging
No.
in safer sex, protecting themselves?
No, but they're not unusual. Students throughout the lower 48 as well experience the same thing. You know, people go to college usually right out of high school. This is the first time that they're out of their safe, warm environment with their parents that's somewhat protected. They begin to experiment, begin to find out a lot about themselves, begin to experience a whole different array of information and lifestyles and behaviors that maybe they haven't seen before. They are attracted to some, repelled by others, engage in a variety of experimentation. That experimenting can, in fact, put them at greater risk because oftentimes it's not with forethought. And we find here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, just like at other universities, students are experimenting a great deal with their sexual beings when they get here. Students come into campus perhaps not having much experience, but end up getting more experience here, and oftentimes in situations that aren't ideal. Drinking behavior, they drink in order to make themselves feel more comfortable, but that also takes away inhibitions, mm-hmm. which also takes away thought processes that allows them to make critical decisions about protecting themselves. In addition, there's some basic problems that we have in our society in that we don't talk about sexual behavior with our children, with our students. We'll talk about the mechanics, but we don't talk about how you form relationships, how you negotiate relationships, how you talk about things like safer sex. That's one thing we found out is the students are very knowledgeable, in fact, at UAF about sexually transmitted diseases. They know how they are prevalent, they know how they get transmitted. What they don't know about is how to talk to another person in such a way as to protect themselves. How do I sit down with my partner and talk about, I really want you to use a condom, or I really want to use a condom, I really want us to protect one another from sexually transmitted diseases. Most students who are here are just beginning their sexual relationships, so even negotiating having sex is big enough for them, let alone let's be safe. Plus, our culture has lots of meanings attached to the ways that we can protect ourselves, such as the use of condoms. You know, there's a lot of negativity on the male's point of view of condoms, seeing as it reduces sensitivity. You may have a loss of momentary loss of erection. It interrupts foreplay. You just don't feel the same, reportedly. The difficulty is you're talking about people who are making those statements oftentimes who have very little experience using condoms, but they've already set a certain attitude that that's the way it is.
Okay. You have been, I want to just do one more kind of foundation laying thought here. You and students in your classes have also been doing focus groups, taking the survey results and kind of pushing them a step further. Tell us the kinds of questions you're asking and the kinds of responses you're getting.
Sure.
Seems very informative.
What we have done is taken the general survey results and said, yes, but what does this mean in terms of actual students? So what my students in a applied communication and training and development class have done is begin to interview cohorts of students throughout campus in small, intimate, informal settings that allows them to explore the depth of what does this mean. And they ask basically three questions. The first is, have you ever encountered a situation where you put yourself at risk at getting a sexually transmitted disease? And can you tell us the story? The second is, what is your regret about that story? What are the regrets in that? And the third is, what would you do differently?
Why are you looking for regrets?
That I think most students, again, being new to the sexual game, they oftentimes will engage in behaviors that put themselves at risk or say, oh my God, I can't believe I did X. And so we're wondering about if we can anticipate what those are, perhaps we can do some training and development activities with students to give them some forethought before that situation actually happens.
And what kinds of things are the young people saying? What's happening with them? What are they regretting or what are they encountering commonly?
We've just finished analyzing the data in a preliminary way and found that there's basically two themes. The first theme, over and over again, is that, yeah, we know what causes sexually transmitted diseases. Yeah, we know how to protect ourselves. But the real problem is, over and over again, how do you sit down and talk to somebody in a relationship about these issues? Because the very talking about it destroys the relationship. That isn't necessarily the truth, but that is the perception. That if I was to bring up, for example, with you, the use of a condom, it would somehow destroy our relationship.
Because I would say, don't you trust me?
Right.
Because I would say, what else? Give me some other ideas.
By me bringing it up, it could imply that I'm not trustworthy.
Oh.
Perhaps I have a sexually transmitted disease, and therefore you need to protect yourself. So it raises questions that if you're uncomfortable with even getting involved in a relationship, it makes it that much harder. So that's the first themes, and we're developing peer education programs now to try to address those, to try to give students the skills for how do you talk about those issues. Mm-hmm. Of course, the first thing you have to do is separate out sex from a relationship. And a lot of the students have difficulty doing that at this point in their lives developmentally because the two are oftentimes inextricably linked. The second theme that was seen over and over again is it really doesn't matter. And that was probably most disheartening for my students to hear, for me to hear, and probably for people in general to hear.
It doesn't matter if what? If I get AIDS?
Right.
Why?
Because the momentary pleasure, the attraction to this person, the heat of the moment, the passion, was somehow worth it.
What does this say about the students who are saying that?
Well, some of that is normal student behavior in the sense that there's developmental issues of this group like we've talked about. Some of those have to do with establishing one's own identity, one's value structure. And at this time in your life, students tend to feel that they're invulnerable, that they can do everything and anything. Although that's a good notion in the sense of pushing oneself and finding one's limits, it's necessarily destructive if you don't understand that there are some consequences for actions that can be lifelong and very severe.
But in that instance, what does it matter means that won't happen, right? Because I am invincible, or at least that's the subtext.
Or if it does, it doesn't matter because the pleasure of the moment was worth it.
Still, all right.
Still.
Okay, what else?
And I think that, for me, this strikes at maybe some differences in this generation from previous generations. I know there's some literature out there saying that this generation is experiencing the world quite differently than perhaps our generation did. We had a fairly firm foundation from which to rebel, from which to say, we don't like this, we don't like that, so we picked and chose what we wanted. We made our choices and was able to react against something. For a large portion of this generation, there's not necessarily that stable world out there. This is the first generation that has experienced a huge increase in divorce rates, with parents separating and oftentimes some of our students going between one parent's house and another. And the idea of a lifelong, long-term relationship isn't necessarily something they've experienced. Even people working out the details of relationships, the day-to-day interactions, to know that if I have a fight with you, it's okay because tomorrow we're still friends, we're still married, we're still whatever. If they haven't had that picture available to them in their families, then it probably is harder for them to see that in the real world of their own relationships.
So the lack of skills that young people experience anyway, because they're still learning, is disabled by the fact that they're not having models for problem solving, negotiation.
It's compounded because our society hasn't given them the traditional kinds of pictures that other times and other places we have had. That's not to say that we should go back to a certain model. It's just simply to say that there isn't a model out there anymore. It's one thing for us to rebel against our parents' values. It's another thing to not know where our parents' values are and to have to sort of figure them out on our own. So it requires a different kinds of approach, I think, to intervening with those people who say it doesn't really matter. They obviously aren't caught in the awareness that it does matter, I just don't know how to enact it, I don't know how to talk about it. I don't even think it matters. So it's going to require different kinds of approach to help them become aware that in fact it does matter, that there are long-term consequences and what those can mean.
Are these kinds of focus groups, these kinds of question and answer sessions, prompting something in your students that is new? I mean, for the first time, isn't it so that they're sitting and listening to their peers talk about things that maybe they haven't talked about before?
Well, a lot of the class is set up to have them enact the very things later on they'll have to do in front of their peers. So in a way, I had them go and talk to their peers to begin with as almost an entry point to begin to assume the role of talking to their peers and then educating them. It was remarkable to see how they processed it in the sense that I encouraged them just to be students, not to be separate from that experience, to participate in discussion but allow for themselves, part of themselves, to be out here observing it. And what they came back and reported was remarkable. Most of them most of them were very surprised by the students that said it doesn't matter. They were taken aback. They had to, and we did spend class time processing that because it seemed so unreal to them. It seemed detrimental against their own values. In fact, they said, if you hadn't told me to keep part of myself out here, I might have lost that. I might have not picked up on that theme and said, oh, it's unimportant. So they are actually discovering something that they might not have seen out there.
We're talking on Conversations to Dr. Donald Novak. He's with the Communications Department here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. His research work is in how systems work. He started out with his master's thesis on families, family systems, whether they work well or don't work, and how to change those systems. He went on to larger systems, working with organizations when he did his PhD, and now is continuing his work to see how groups work and how people can change here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We're talking about a survey that went out to 2,500 students and was filled out by 800 and some. Seven pages long, 51 detailed questions talking about sexual attitudes, behaviors, knowledge, and also drug and alcohol behavior. Are young people, we perceive that young people are living in a more, in a time that's more filled with risk. Is that true as far as you're concerned? Or does every era have risks that new generations have to fight their way through?
Well, I think probably both are true. Every generation does have to reinvent the world for themselves and create new meaning, create new ways of believing, new ways of relating to themselves and their world. But I think this is a very different context than ever has existed before. So to say that it's at once similar and also different is probably to speak closer to the truth. Specifically, I think they have problems that we cannot necessarily understand, that are their own, that we can't necessarily offer good advice since they are experiencing them for the first time. They were a generation of people who parents increasingly got divorced, whose lifestyles have heated up from being usually a one-person breadwinner type family to both parents working. Even if they stayed together, they were both working very hard, had limited time, spent a great deal of energy getting tasks done for the family, but not a lot of family time. And most of that is just economic nature of our country now. Most people have to work to maintain the standards of living that we've learned to enjoy. But that has tremendous, I think, effects on people because their worldview becomes to be real different.
You called this generation the baby bust or baby buster generation. What does that mean?
Well, in some of the research that's been cited about this generation, they've said that we sort of contrast it with our generation, the baby boomers. We were optimistic. We felt we could change the world. We did lots of things to evidence that. We were more optimistic. We felt that we could make a difference. There was a great number of us that went off into professions that, in fact, were trying to make a difference. And we made some substantial changes. If you look at women and minorities, if you look at a variety of things in the educational front, the baby busters arrived at a time when the coffers were empty. The families were different. The outlook in the country were quite different. And so their notion of what was possible, what is good, what is wholesome, has changed significantly.
Let's look at solutions. You are implying, I feel, that this generation may not have the solutions for that generation to carry them through the time of HIV and other and more complicated sexually transmitted diseases, not to mention other rocks and shoals. Do the solutions, do the tools then rest with this new generation? And what do you see emerging as tools for change or tools for coping?
Well, I think that we as a society have to make some fundamental changes. First of all, we do have to talk to them. I think being honest about our parents didn't talk to us about sex either. Mm. Our parents didn't say how you formulate a relationship. For them it was a given, and for us it seemed to be a given. No longer do we have the luxury of it being a given, that we have to have ways to protect ourselves, ways to ensure that I'm getting my needs met, but also that I am not doing something that has long-term consequences that will create problems for me, my family, my potential family, whoever. The change that needs to occur is we've, as a society, have loosened up morals in the sense of it's okay to display sex on MTV, on all the multimedia venues. It's okay to talk about those issues. You can say all the seven dirty words now on TV. Mm. You can do a variety of things. But do we show also on TV people negotiating a relationship? What does it mean to sit down and say, hi, I'd like to get closer to you? And how do people go about doing that? We don't talk about that.
Would you put that on MTV?
Yes.
Yeah.
I put that on MTV. I'd make it real that relationships aren't happily ever after. Hollywood gives this wonderful notion. I myself buy into it. You know, you want to go see something like Pretty Woman that has this wonderful ending that makes you feel like it's all going to work out in the end. We, as an American culture, have that inherent optimism that it will all work out in the end. Well, it takes a lot of hard work to have things work out, and they aren't always happily ever after. Now, some of that hard work actually eventuates in a love and passion of what happens, and a deeper understanding and a deeper appreciation. But somehow we don't communicate that through the mass media. We don't say to our youngsters, listen, engaging in relationships is hard work, and there's benefits from it. It's not just that it's hard work, and if it gets too hard, you can split. But it's hard work, and there's benefits for you and for the other person.
Okay, so talk about it. You and me talk about it with young people. That's the first thing. But you also think, throw it out to the world. Put it on MTV, put it on the nightly news, put it in the sitcoms. What else? What other tools do these kids need that either we have for them and can offer them, or we don't, and they're going to develop themselves?
Well, I think some that they'll have to develop themselves that have nothing to do with us is their vision of the future. You know, we have a vision of the future based a lot of part on where we grew up and things that we'd like to see, things that we call America and things that we call hopeful in and things that we want to give to our children. They have to create that whole agenda for themselves. What will it be? How will it manifest itself in the way they relate to one another? How will it manifest itself in the way they relate to the earth, to their educational system, to their families? What are they going to create? I think it's important to let them know that that is their agenda, mm-hmm. that they have the power to do that, that it's not a given out there that somehow other people can define for them. In fact, they shouldn't wait around for somebody else to define it for them, that they have to create it.
And this, too, is difficult because everywhere there's evidence of other things, especially unseen forces, creating the agenda, right?
Right.
I mean, the movies do it, the government does it, it's all in somebody else's hands.
That's right.
So,
and that goes back to STDs. They're in somebody else's hands too.
Yeah.
And they're not. And that's one of the messages we're trying to get out over and over again, is that only you can protect yourself. And you have to make strategies that go along with your values that protect you. Be that abstinence, be that use of condoms, be that limited kinds of sexual activity, you name it. But you need to do something to protect yourself, to make the choices. And not rely on anybody else, your partner or other societal institutions or whatever, to solve the problem for you.
Are the students in your classes becoming better prepared because they're doing focus groups, because they're talking? Is this a tool also?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the hidden agendas that every educator has is that not only will people learn what's on the page, but in somehow incorporate that in their lives. And I see that in every way, because When they came back from, for example, from the focus groups, they began to evidence some of the concern, some of the horror, some of the outright regret that adults verbalize about their own peers, and sort of raise their consciousness, oh my God, there really is a problem out there. I had no idea. If I can give you some stories mm-hmm. that really raised some of the consciousness. This one group of women, one of my students was doing a focus group, and a woman said, you know, I really have no problem sleeping with a person on a team, sports, and that would be fine. I would love the popularity. I would love the esteem it would give me. And I don't care about the consequences because the esteem is worth it. And other members of that group chimed in and said, yeah. Uh-huh. That somehow the status and the privilege that would confer upon me, regardless of the risk, was worth it.
Donald, this sounds just like 20, 30 years ago. 30 years ago in high school, you wore his letter jacket, his letter sweater. Or his ring.
Wrapped right. in yarn.
Wrapped in yarn, of course, or hung it around your neck.
Right.
So we're kind of dealing with the same tools.
That's right. We're dealing with the same tools, but the games have changed substantially.
More serious.
Now, you can die if you make a mistake. Mm-hmm. You just don't get pregnant. I know people might think they're going to die that when those choices are provided for them, but that's quite different than if you get the virus that causes AIDS, HIV. Mm-hmm. If you get that, it's over.
This survey was funded by the Centers for Disease Control through the American College Health Association. The researchers, including Donald Novak, our guest today on Conversations, also included Dr. Dale Fadnes, an associate professor. His emphasis is on marketing, and he's in the Business Administration Department here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And Dr. Melinda Evans, who is the campus physician. The research was headed by the UAF Center for Health and Counseling here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We have moments left, and I'm curious to know what you feel is the most important thing this survey is offering to this university.
Well, the most important thing is to say that students are sexually active, that they are out there putting themselves at risk every day, that they are not only doing that, but they're only 20% of them take precautions to protect themselves. Most of them know, absolutely know, what causes a sexually transmitted disease and know ways to protect themselves, but also don't take that either seriously enough to do something about it or don't know how to negotiate and talk it through. It's a problem that we all need to pay attention to and absolutely do something about. If I could show evidence that one student somehow, through the survey, through the class, through the peer education program, was saved from getting an STD, that's good enough because it makes a statement that you can do something. And I know my students feel more and more empowered in the peer education course, more and more empowered that they can do something because they understand that there is something that needs to be done.
In absence of a perfect solution, is just the awareness an important tool? Students are at risk. This is a serious situation.
Well, I think it goes beyond being awareness. We have to absolutely do something. We have to allow, for example, condoms to be available everywhere. We have to do a systematic campaign to keep people informed and keep this issue in their face, so that they understand it's not going to go away. It's not the issue of the week. For people who have HIV, like Magic Johnson, it's an everyday phenomenon, and everybody needs to know that and understand that when you make your choices in this area, you make them for your lifetime, and that needs to constantly be put in people's face so they understand that. It's real easy when you're young, you know that and I know that, to forget that, to be wrapped up into the moment, to get into the romance of the situation, the fun of the situation, the pure hormones of the situation. But no longer does this generation have that luxury.